This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zaid. The Rohingya refugee crisis exploded in 2015 when thousands of Rohingya people fled to neighboring countries like Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines to escape persecution. Many escaped with the service of human traffickers. Now, as of October 2016, there are more than 54,000 Rohingya refugees and asylum seekers in the country. There is yet to an end to the Rohingya crisis, and the delay in finding a solution has created a new problem: forced marriages. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Young girls and women are trafficked into Malaysia to marry men years older than they are. These marriages are often done with the hope that these girls can have a better life in Muslim-majority countries such as Malaysia and Indonesia. Mahi Ramakrishnan's latest film shows that that's not usually the case. Her film, that's yet to be premiered, called Beau, which means bride, explores that very topic, and she joins us in the studio today to talk about the issue of forced child marriages. Joining her is Hafsar Tamisuddin. Hafsar is a Rohingya herself, and she works very closely with the community that lives here in Malaysia. Ladies, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Now, Mahi, let's begin with you. You're about to premiere this film called Beau. It's going to premiere at the Refugee Fest. The theme is inclusion for a better world, and that you're also organizing yourself. You're a very busy lady. Maybe tell us a little bit more about the film and the festival as a whole.
I wanted to make the film because of the trafficking element in it. But when I started doing the research, I realized it wasn't just the traffickers who were bringing these kids and forcing them into marriages so that they can get paid. I realized that there were many other complex elements involved in the child trafficking and child brides, child marriages amongst the Rohingya. One of it is that the Rohingya men themselves commission the traffickers to find them child brides from their own village in Arakan. The other thing is that there is a new route which allows for the trafficking of girls to continue despite the fact that the sea route is closed, or what we largely believe is closed due to the stringent monitoring. And the fact also remains that while it's not exclusive to the Rohingya, child marriages is very much culturally entrenched within the community, making child protection almost impossible. So these are some of the elements that cropped up, and they have been incorporated into the film itself so that anyone watching it will be able to understand the issue, not just from a trafficking perspective, but from its in its entirety.
Hafsar, you worked very closely with Mahi on this film. Tell us, you know, culturally, when it comes to forced marriages, how do we make sense of them and trying to understand why this happens?
If I have to talk about why this thing happened, I'm going to go back to the culturally perspective on the girls and women itself, because there are a lot of people trafficked by the traffickers, not only girls and women, also men. So for the men, they have options, a lot of options, okay? Maybe you might they might be sold for work or other things, but for the girls, there is no option. They are just being sold like the properties of the man, I'm sorry to say that. So I feel so bad about it, and it's about their belief and, you know, norm, social norm, and it's about gender stereotyping things, and their view on the girls and women, it's also creating this path, you know? They themselves is viewing them, okay, we are buying the properties for ourselves. So in my belief personally, I believe that marriage should have between mutual understanding. There shouldn't be any peer pressure from either side. So
there
it's
has
not
to be
happening.
Mutual consent.
Yes. So, but this thing is going on, and I don't think these girls themselves know that they have the right to say yes or no, and they are being forced into this. So,
Mahi, I guess, you know, when we talk about human trafficking and the Rohingya community, this issue has been going on for quite a number of years. When did the issue of forced marriages come into your radar as you became more aware of this issue?
Actually, I've worked with the Rohingya community quite closely over the last 11 years. And 5 years ago, I saw kids carrying children. And when I started asking more questions, I was quite shocked to find out that they were already mothers, that their children were theirs. So it was already in my radar. But because I was also trying to do other films about the Rohingya, it kind of was in the back burner. And now that I finished a film on the trafficking of the Rohingya from Burma to Malaysia, looking at the entire process as to the sea journey that they make coming into Malaysia, I decided that this is the right time to do it. And also because, you know, it's also a film that closes the Refugee Festival on the 13th of August at 5:30 p.m. That's when the film is premiering. I thought that it's a good topic to introduce so that I can use this topic to engage the UNHCR to work at, number one, documenting the child brides, because we don't have any idea as to how many children have been forced into marriage.
There's no data available?
There's absolutely no data available. You can ask Hafsa. Is there anything available?
I don't think so, because there are a lot of brides. We don't even know where they are. Mm. I mean, they are forced to be in specific places. We can't reach them, and they can reach to us, I think, most of them.
Yeah, so UNHCR, to work together with UNHCR, first, to document the child brides. Secondly, to look at mental health intervention, because, you know, these children have suffered horrific abuses. I don't even know where to begin. For example, there was this this girl that I interviewed. She's now almost 14. She left her home when she was 11, and she was sexually abused, beaten, traumatized, tortured because she had absolutely no money to pay the traffickers. And she told me that she was raped by close to 60 traffickers, if not more. Mm. By the time she was 12 and a half, 13, she was already pregnant. She didn't know who the trafficker, the father was, which trafficker. And she had a miscarriage. So imagine the trauma, the mental trauma that these children go through. And they're also caught in marriages where they continue to be abused by the husbands. So UNHCR, to document the cases, to work with UNHCR, to look at mental health intervention. And then I believe that these children, they cannot suffer this persecution because of geography and birth.
Right.
So we really need to look at ways in which they can be given skills, that they can go through some training, some skills training, so that they will be able to be financially independent, that they will be able to work.
I mean, what you just described is an extreme version of torture almost to any individual, let alone a child. And, you know, the image that you painted earlier of, you know, pretty much a young child still carrying another baby, you would like to think in the best of circumstances that they are siblings.
Exactly.
But in fact, that they are not. Hafsa, you know, given how many children are involved in forced marriages, is there any pushback within the community itself to stop this from happening, or is it come to a stage where it's almost accepted begrudgingly?
Honestly, I don't know how many children are being forced, but I can say there's not less. There are a lot. Like I said, we can reach to them, they can reach to us, because they are being trafficked and they are being kept by their husband. And even if they got married, they are not free to go out. They are not free to speak to the people. I don't know in which kind of situation they are living in, but I don't think our society itself is ready to stop it happening, because, like I said, religious-wise, cultural-wise, traditional-wise, they believe it's normal. Okay. Mm. When the girls become to puberty and she became a virgin, okay, we can let her go for marriage. It's fine. And I don't think a lot of people thinks about, you know, how this girl will go through these marriages, how she will be suffering, and whether is this girl is ready for her, you know, physically, mentally. They don't care about it, as far as I can see. So we still need to work it on a lot. It might not be easy. I know it might be challenging, but we have to start to do it. And when I say this, what Mahi did, the film, it will be so effective. I am so glad you did that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mahi, for on behalf of Rohingya community.
And Mahi, I guess, you know, just that description of that 11-year-old girl who was a child bride, is there a sense of awareness about the abuse that she is experiencing, or is she retelling this to as much as she is aware?
See, the thing is that I don't think many people know the extent of the abuse, because, like I said, nobody has spoken to them. This issue has not been widely looked at. So it was really difficult for her to tell us the story in the first place. She did say that every time she thinks back about what happened
yes.
to her, she's not even able to eat. And the film ends with her saying that she feels like killing herself. It was also very difficult for me to make this film. I'm a mother myself, and it's so difficult to look at these children and just just be a filmmaker there. So when I was doing this interview particularly, I had to stop it halfway. I couldn't continue. I just gave her a hug and just sat there, completely traumatized myself. So imagine what she would have gone through. But I don't think that the public are aware of it. When I say child marriages, that they have been trafficked, I don't think the public understand the extent of sexual abuse suffered by the children at the hands of the traffickers and also their husbands. Because this girl goes on to tell me that her husband treated her exactly the same way in which the traffickers treated her, sexually abused her, forced sex on her, and she fled. But I would also like to say that all these kids that I interviewed, they were able to tell me their story with lots of courage. And there's one hope that they hold on to. They say that while their life is ruined, they want better education for the child. They want a future for the child. And I think it's the responsibility of me as a filmmaker, of the society, of UNHCR, NGO, civil society, to make this happen.
Now, Mahi, after this, I'd like to speak to you about how these girls get into Malaysia in the first place. More from Mahi Ramakrishnan and Hafsa Tamisuddin after this on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Break from mediocrity, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. In our studio is Mahi Ramakrishnan and Hafsar Tamisuddin. We're talking about a film that Mahi directed, and it's about Rohingya child brides in Malaysia. Mahi, your film, it's called Bo, and it translates to bride, and you know, it explores this topic of forced marriages. You told us earlier that, you know, in many of the interviews that you conducted for this film, one of them was an 11-year-old girl. You also spoke to three men who paid for child brides. And of course, as we discussed earlier, many of us are probably unaware that this is happening, that young Rohingya girls are being trafficked into the country to be brides for Rohingya men. Can you describe the context as to how this is happening? Are parents selling their children? Are they being abducted? Is it a more complicated picture?
I think through one of the interviews that I did with Hafsa in the film, she explains this. She talks about how because of the continuing persecution against the Rohingya in Burma, a lot of these traffickers are capitalizing on it. What they do is they get someone whom the parents know, the families are, know, and then they tell them that your daughters are way better off, they're way safer in Malaysia, so we will bring them to Malaysia. You don't worry, you don't even have to pay for the journey. And then they get trafficked and they get sexually abused and sold into marriages.
The initial offer is very, very hard for parents to refuse, I
exactly,
imagine.
Because, you know, there's killings everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
And there's no solution in sight.
Right.
So, and then you also have children who are forced to flee because the parents get killed. The family is murdered. Brothers and sisters are all dead and gone. And, you know, when they see military advancing into their villages, what they do is they run together with others in the village. Some end up in Bangladesh and then they make their way into Malaysia because, you know, it's a predominantly Muslim country and there are lots of Rohingya here. So they think that they can find some kind of solidarity amongst them. And the reason I interviewed the men is because I really wanted to get into their head and see what is it that they were thinking about.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because all of them thought that they were actually saviors in some sort, that they were actually saving these children because they come here, they are with the traffickers, they are stranded, they're open to more abuse. And so they're marrying them and in that manner saving them. But what happens is after the marriage, they abandon them. Most of the husbands run away when the wives get pregnant. In fact, they get so angry when the wives get pregnant. Don't ask me why. And also, those who still stay with the husbands, they get beaten up every time they ask for more money to buy milk and to buy food. So this is what is happening. And the film also shows you the process in which it happens, how the traffickers get hold of the Rohingya men and how the Rohingya men know that or end up knowing that there are children that they can buy and marry. So it looks at the entire process, how the payment is made and what happens after that.
You know, Hafsar, just from that particular description, there are some real life decisions to be made under very difficult circumstances for the Rohingya community. And at the same time, there's also this perverse logic, right? That, you know, you might on one hand think that you're saving another member from your own community, but yet absolve full responsibility in undertaking that sort of circumstance. Do you think that this is something that the men realize that they're being involved with?
I don't think they fully realize about it. Like Mahi said, they are even thinking themselves they are the heroes. They are saving the girl's life because I don't think they have enough knowledge of this marriage and also, you know, rape. And when I say rape, I mean when someone forces you to have sex, it's considered as rape. Even if you are married with this man, it should be always on mutual understanding and consent. So they are thinking that they are even saving these girls, and they won't have this, you know, knowledge that they are doing this thing.
When we talk about these young girls, can we have a description as to how young are we talking about? What's the age range? What's the demographic that we're referring to?
Well, the ones I interviewed are between the ages of 13 and 15, 13 and 16, actually. But the 16-year-old doesn't even look 16, so 13 to 15, I would say it.
Yeah, because they don't have birth certificate. They don't even know how old they are.
Right.
And when I work with this community, a lot of people came for interview, the young girls. When I look at them, I feel so bad. Their age are like 12 and 13. The husband she is married to is 30 years older than her. And I was thinking how she is surviving into this. And I can see on her face that she has no interest into this marriage. And even the baby she's carrying, even if she is a mother, she is not ready to be a mother yet. So sometimes I saw that she is even neglecting her baby because she is angry with her life. She is angry all the things that she has experienced. And the only person she can, you know, expose this anger is to her baby. So it's so bad.
Yeah, it's very cynical as well.
Yes. One of the girls that I interviewed also said that the husband faked her age in when he registered her at the government hospital because Malaysia does not allow you to have, you know, you can't have children. She said, they had to register the birth. And so the husband said she was 18 years old.
When in fact, they could very well be younger.
Yeah, she's only 14.
Yeah. And this undertaking to be a mother is something that a child bride is emotionally and mentally not prepared for, let alone physically. What sources of support do they have, if at all?
You mean from the community itself?
From the community in any shape, way or form, because, you know, we know that it takes a village to raise a child. But if there are so many of these circumstances happening where these child brides are mothers as well, and the fathers are abstaining from responsibility, what support do they have?
I don't think they have a lot of support. I will say they don't even have any support at all.
And what happens as a result in terms of the relationship between the mother and the child?
Like I said, you know, when these girls are very angry what had happened to them and they are being treated by their husband very badly, like Mahi said, sexually, physically, they are being abused. So the only way they can get out this stress and they can explode this anger is to their babies. So they don't even know that they are abusing back their kids because they feel it's normal. Okay, somebody is let's say about the power. Her husband has hold higher power than her. This guy abused her, and the baby is, of course, she can, you know, do whatever she likes. So, and I think UNHCR has to focus more about this thing and to be able to reach out to the people who are really in need of their help.
Mahi, when you were, you know, producing this film, did you discover that it was actually quite easy to meet young child brides who had experiences, or was it something that you had to dig a little bit deeper than and scratch beyond the surface level?
Actually, I worked with a fixer, Sharifa Shakira, who's the founder of the Rohingya Women Development Network, and she's a, like Hafsa, she's a woman leader. So I worked with her, and she already knows these child brides. So it wasn't a big thing. And I don't think that it's going to be that difficult. I mean, when you walk into a Rohingya settlement, wherever you turn, you will see children carrying their babies. So it's not like something which is so hidden that you have to unearth it. If you are really interested in helping them, you will find them. It's that easy.
Did you want to say something?
Yeah, because they think it's normal. They don't think something is wrong with that. It's become, you know, numb for them. Okay, normal. So they don't hide it.
We've got the news coming up, but after this, more on the issue of forced marriages and Rohingya child brides with Mahi and Hafsar. We'll find out if there'll be an end to this problem anytime soon. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Because freedom matters. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed. Today, we've been talking about Rohingya child brides in Malaysia. Young Rohingya girls are trafficked into the country to marry men years older than they are. These girls are forced into these marriages and usually end up in very abusive relationships. Mahi Ramakrishnan made a film about this, and we're talking to her about it. Joining her is Hafsar Tamisuddin, who works closely with the Rohingya community here. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the process of trafficking. Could you, either of you, describe how exactly do these girls and women cross the border? Because as you mentioned, there are more stringent circumstances in which how people are crossing the border. How exactly do people make it across that journey?
Actually, all these kids that were interviewed, they had come in after the 2012 violence. And I believe that before 2016, because following 2015, after the boat crisis, there's been stringent monitoring. So the boats arriving from Burma to Malaysia via Thailand, via the ocean, the sea, that has stopped. But an interview with the trafficker for this film reveals that another trafficking route is possible. So it's like the more you up the enforcement, the more creative the traffickers seem to get.
Right.
So here the trafficker explains about how the Bengali traffickers in Bangladesh forged the passports of these girls, bribe the immigration officers there, and once they get 8 to 10 girls, they fly with them to Malaysia and bribe their way through the Malaysian immigration to bring them into Malaysia. And these children are sold for 16,000 Malaysian ringgit. Now, the husbands that I interviewed, and there's this guy who is now in the process of buying a bride, they paid about 7,000 ringgit to the trafficker. So when I tried digging a little bit further with this trafficker as to where these children are going, he just went silent. So I do not know where these kids are going, because 16,000 ringgit is something that the Rohingya men will never be able to pay.
Right. So that was what I was thinking. You know, I was trying to figure out how much they charge for each girl. And 16,000 ringgit, it's a lot of money.
Exactly. So, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, I do not know this.
Sure.
I've not done any investigative work. I haven't spoken to anyone. But I wouldn't be surprised if they are being, you know, channeled into the child porn industry or the child sex industry. Anything is possible.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm also hoping to share this piece of information with Charles Santiago, the YB Charles Santiago, the Klang MP, as well as the chairperson of ASEAN Parliamentarians for Human Rights, so that he can put the agenda of trafficking back on an ASEAN level as well as in Malaysian Parliament. And I would also like to work together with Angel Fernandez of Tanaga Nita, because she sits on the Anti-Trafficking Council.
Yeah.
I just believe that my role as a filmmaker doesn't just end with me making the film.
It's trying to connect the dots.
Exactly,
as well.
Connecting the people, making sure that whatever pertinent information that I gather is channeled to the right people so that they can take up on these issues and work on them.
Hafsar, once these child brides are trafficked into the country, what happens to them? And is there any way in which they can stay in contact with their families back in Myanmar?
I don't think so. First of all, you know, there are some girls that I went to interpret for them as I work for some organization. Then they just told me that they just got jumped into the boat because they can't live there in their country and they have no family member. And even if they have parents, their parents are worried for their safety because there are a lot of rape cases happening by the soldiers. So they just get into the boat. They don't even know where they are going to. So when they arrive to some point in between, maybe in Bangladesh or in Thailand, they don't have phone, first of all, in their hand. They don't have any cash, any money with them. So as long as the traffickers don't let them talk to anyone, I don't think they will be able to talk to anybody.
Are there circumstances in which these young girls leave their marriages? And if they aren't able to, what are some of the repercussions for those who have attempted to?
Well, I don't think that they're able to leave the marriages. Like I said, some of them, most of them get abandoned by the husbands the minute they get pregnant.
To begin with, yeah.
Exactly. And this 13-year-old, she fled the marriage because the husband was forcing sex on her. And she said that it was just too painful for her. She couldn't deal with it anymore. So she fled. But I don't think that is an option for many Rohingya girls because, again, of the indoctrination and the cultural practice, you know, the fact that, and they say that when I spoke to them, they said that, okay, I don't love my husband, but what can I possibly do? I already have a child with him and I don't know anyone. I don't have money. I don't have education. I can't speak the language here. I can't work, so where am I going to go?
Yeah, it's because of their because of the lack of recognition in terms of their status, they are invisible because law enforcement doesn't engage with them in a meaningful way that serves anyone's interests.
Exactly. I don't know how the police will handle the case, for example, if they go to the police station and report domestic violence. I mean, I don't know. I mean,
where
these
do
people
you begin?
Exactly.
Yeah.
These people are invisible in the first place. So I don't know whether that police report will actually amount to anything.
Because I think what's also concerning is that a lot of these young girls are pushed into really, really desperate circumstances, and there's no way, from the sounds of it at least, that there's no avenue for help. And how are they engaging you, Hafsar? How are you connecting yourself to this community and trying to make sense of this?
My roles, I most of the time I work as a, you know, translator and interpreter. So whoever work for this stuff, human trafficking and child bride, or for this processing things, and I went along with them as an interpreter. So I hear everything, I see everything. So they are desperately in need of help, but then there are very less. I can say there is almost no place where they can seek for help, and they don't know where to go, and they don't know how they can reach out to those people and to that organization. Like Mahi said, they don't speak the language. They have no documents. They don't know how to even get out from the house and get something to buy for themselves. So they are being locked in those situations, and I feel so bad about it. And I am worried that they might end up with this idea, societal idea, because, okay, my life is finished. I have been through a lot of things, and until I am now in Malaysia, I can't see any hope. I am being blocked in this situation. So it might lead them even for societal idea.
Mahi, given the nature of this story and the topic itself, did you encounter any hopeful circumstances to this?
That's a very tough question. Because the answer is no. It was just dark, morbid, and complete hopelessness. Unless and until there is some form of intervention from people such as NGOs, civil society, the UNHCR. It's not going to happen on its own, you know. It's not like they're going to up and leave or up and suddenly get empowered. It's just not possible. So unless there is intervention, and I hope that there will be, and I really hope to travel with the film to connect the dots with all the key stakeholders.
Can we talk a little bit more about these key stakeholders, the local authorities and NGO, and the NGOs? Have many of them been certainly at least aware of this particular situation, and what efforts have been made to address this in any particular way?
I don't think there has been any effort in the first place. Even if there were any, it would have been piecemeal, you know, just dealing with the situation. If at all any of the organizations were confronted with a child bride, then it's a different story. But I don't think that there has been any concerted effort on to kind of like lobby NGOs and civil society together with the UNHCR. I think maybe the UNHCR can start doing it, lobby the various NGOs as well as the civil society, not just here regionally. Because yes, while we are talking about the fact that this happens amongst the Rohingya, it's not exclusive to the Rohingya. So I think that the UNHCR can pan it out to look at various other refugee communities in Malaysia as well. So because nothing has happened so far, I'm hoping that this film will at least start a conversation so that the stakeholders, those people who can, who are in a position to look at various ways in which they can look into the solution, will be able to work together.
Hafsar, you know, is that something that you're excited about as well when it comes to at least this film and starting a conversation within the Rohingya community about this issue? Because a lot of these elements are so patriarchal in nature of how society functions, about the role of men, about the role of women. Is that something that you're quite hopeful about, for that needle to move, for the conversation to change a little bit?
Yes, I do hope. But then it won't be very easy, because when you are used to be in this, you know, system for a long time, and when there is a time come up, you need to change the way you think. You need to change the way you view on the girls and women. So it's kind of gonna be hard for the men, I think, to change the way they have been thinking for over generations and generation again. But I do hope this film will bring some, you know, hope for the girls and to prevent in future event, and also to be able to help them who have been already trafficked and who have been already in those dark, hopeless places. Maybe any NGO, local or international NGO, might step in and take a step for, you know, to help them. I really hope.
Maya, this film is going to be a great way to shine a spotlight. What are your hopes for this film? Because it's certainly not easy to address the topic just in terms of the content alone, but producing this particular film with the financial backing that it requires, with the local support that the community needs to give this particular film so that it gains traction and attention to the right people.
Firstly, I'm hoping to be able to screen it as widely as possible in as many cities as possible, not just in Malaysia, Southeast Asia, Europe, and possibly circulate the film in the US as well. Because like I said, I would really like to connect the various stakeholders who are in different parts of the world so that everyone can come together to at least look into the problem and look into ways in which they can find a solution. At least look into ways in which they can help the children from henceforth. And I will be really disappointed if I'm not able to see something actually happen on the ground, because it's very difficult to make a film like this and then to say that my work is done and see nothing come out of it, to see that the lives of the children remain the same. That's incredibly difficult for me as a filmmaker. So the most important thing for me is to really connect the dots, connect the stakeholders, and make sure that something happens on the ground, at least as a first step, the documentation happens, and then mental health intervention happens. And then in the longer run, looking into possibilities of training them so that they have some skills, so that they can work, so that they can have a semblance of life. Their childhood has been robbed of them forever, again, because of birth and geography. And that's it just cannot end that way.
Mahi Hafsar, thank you very much for coming to the studios and sharing this particular story with us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I've been speaking to Mahi Ramakrishnan. She's the director of Beau, which translates to Bride, and it premieres at the Refugee Fest, Inclusion for a Better World. The festival is happening August 10th to 13th at Black Box Publica. You also heard from Hafsar Tamisuddin, a Rohingya activist. If you know someone who's passionate about refugee rights in the country, recommend this podcast to them. They can get it from our BFM app, and it's available on the Apple App Store and on Google Play. You're listening to The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.